Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and hello, and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Robert LaMagna Reiter. He is the Chief Information Security Officer, or CISO, at an MSP cloud provider known as FNTS. They're based in Omaha, Nebraska. Rob, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Absolutely. I appreciate the invitation to join you this afternoon.
Thank you. Now, Rob, we did a little bit of background snooping on you on LinkedIn, Google, and your website, and it sounds like you got a very wide range of leadership roles in IS and cybersecurity in different industries. Can you please kind of tell us the highlights of your career and what brought you to FNTS?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in the information security world as a professional for nearly 15 years. It's been the primary focus of my career, and actually going through, you know, higher ed at the university here in Omaha, I was going through some of the early programs when information assurance and cybersecurity were really becoming, you know, solidified. So it piqued my curiosity from the beginning. One of my first roles that I think set the stage for my curiosity and thirst for knowledge and wanting to build resistant networks was working for a government telecommunications and infrastructure provider. It was probably one of the most complex, massive networks that I got to work with a team of extremely talented, colleagues and leadership on. And from there, it propelled me throughout my career to dabble in, some startup space with companies here in Omaha that then were sold to some of the, the Fortune 100 players. And then what led me from the world of government communications and transportation and retail e-commerce to an MSP and TSP was the ability to not only help secure and be a leader for information security within the organization, but the ability to interface, partner, and work with our diverse client set. It's a very unique opportunity that I get to see both sides of the information security, both challenges and successes, both ourselves, using ourselves as a reference point, and then helping to understand how diverse yet similar all of the problems organizations across the nation are trying to solve, and how we can work together to build successful long-term implementations and operational models that over time are strategic enablers, but then make security that value add, that value proposition for the organization to operate nimbly. So that's what drew me to FNTS and the consumption and need for cloud and managed services is only growing. So it's also fast-paced. And always an exciting thing every day.
Sure, definitely. Now, can you give us some background, please, onto FNTS, which is obviously an acronym for First National Technology Solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. You were spot on earlier. I'll just elaborate a bit more. We are a cloud managed and security services provider supporting probably the largest array of technology platforms that I'm familiar with, right? Everything from your mainframe and iSeries, a VMware-powered private cloud that we host and maintain ourselves and offer to customers, and then cloud and managed services in the public cloud sectors with specifically Microsoft and AWS. So we're celebrating our 25th year this year. We were founded in 1995, and we're a wholly owned subsidiary of First National Nebraska, which is the holding company for the largest private U.S. bank. And what we do for customers is advise, build, migrate, and manage several platforms, which I referred to earlier, and we're located our primary location and data centers in Omaha, Nebraska. And I would wrap it up with saying what sets us apart is probably our focus for customer satisfaction and service delivery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. Now, with COVID-19, we've now realized that the having a 99% remote workforce is now possible. You know, a lot of cyber pundits were thinking it was going to be a few more years out. But now we're seeing this transformation actually happen now in just a period of 2 months. And we can probably call this a digital transformation era right now, if there is anything good that were to come out of COVID. Now, how is FNTS assisting your clients or other companies, maybe not in technology, with coming to this realization of digital transformation?
Yeah, absolutely. Our biggest value add for our customers is centered around those key areas that I just mentioned, the advisement building, migrating management and securing of those digital transformation initiatives that you just spoke to. What we found pre and post COVID, it was just accelerated by the COVID-19 operating environment and the rush to make work from home the normal, was that we always recommend the right size business aligned solutions. And so our dedicated service delivery team that is phenomenal when they deliver, the boutique customized services for our customers, we're able to spin up a wide variety of remote enablement technology platforms, everything from virtual desktop to public cloud, powered by the Microsoft Enterprise Suite, Office 365, Microsoft Teams and whatnot. And the great thing is of being a very remote friendly organization first, we were able to use what we do for ourselves as a blueprint to help guide and advise some of our clients. So we were able to turn what is a very challenging situation for a lot of organizations and people into something that we could help lessen that pain of that transformation. And then once we get them operational and adjusted, how do we continue to mature and make that an integral part of their business?
Okay, excellent. Now, who's your typical customer base that you're trying to target? Would it be the small to medium-sized businesses or the Fortune 500, or perhaps a combination of both?
Yeah, our target client I would say, is described as an organization that has a revenue range anywhere from $200 million to $3 billion. So it's primarily that mid-market, some of the small, but primarily that mid-market. We do focus and specialize in certain industries due to our ownership structure. We are very heavy in financial and insurance, healthcare, and then those organizations that have been around for a number of years that have what they consider to be maybe some technical debt, and that they're looking to embark on further digital transformation initiatives, and they need to merge several technology platforms into a more consolidated and efficient manner to enable their operations. And then I would say the biggest commonality amongst our customer base is that they value that partnership and thought leadership. They're not looking for a transactional relationship. They're looking for an extension of their business that's going to help advise and guide. That's probably the biggest characteristic of our customer base, and which makes the relationship all the more successful.
Awesome. Now, do you have any customer success stories you can share with us? Obviously, I don't want you to release any client names or anything, but on a macro level, can you share some success stories or client testimonials that you had good experiences with?
Sure thing, absolutely. I think one of the most recent examples that we worked with to publish a case study has been the local municipality, Metropolitan Utilities District here in Omaha, Nebraska. We were able to help them work through an entirely digital transformation initiative, get out of their data center and transform into a pure cloud organization. Partnered with us for both cloud and managed services, and we're able to allow their IT teams to focus, more on their business and deliver value back to the organization in a cost-effective manner. So I know I'm not doing the case study justice by providing the summary, but we do have some, video testimonials, white paper case studies that anybody listening can feel free to go out to our website and take a look. Don't just take my word for it. listen to some of the stakeholders, including the, you know, the president of MUD that worked with us and has been a big proponent of not just the services, but how seamless we were able to make that migration.
Okay, excellent. Now, in today's times, you know, there's so many cybersecurity vendors out there. They offer kind of like bits and pieces to fill the entire cybersecurity puzzle for like a potential client. So, for example, if there's company XYZ, they want like an all-encompassing cybersecurity package. There's so many vendors out there, you know, that offer like bits and pieces to kind of fill that entire jigsaw puzzle for them. But how would it, like an SMB like partnering with FNTS or a managed services provider like you be a good investment? Can you fill in all those pieces of that cyber jigsaw puzzle, if you will, for your client?
Sure. We certainly can fill in quite a few of the needs that those small to mid enterprises have. And the great thing is about being a cloud and managed service provider and partner to those organizations is while we can provide the not just the platform and the knowledge and the guidance to enable them strategically for work from anywhere and cloud endpoint and, you know, fully managed 24/7 detection and response, anything that we might have a gap or we've identified a gap with our customers, we have a robust partner ecosystem and a robust channel system that we can recommend based on both our experience and positive feedback, those that can fill in gaps that we may not bring to the table. So we've made a deliberate focus on what we do well, what we can deliver well, and we'll bring to the table a wide-ranging, well-encompassing solution set that is based on you know, experience, fact, and based on recommendations from other clients in the area. So in the end, a small to mid-enterprise can count on us to assist them with their needs in mind. So if it's something we're not able to deliver, we're going to help guide them on a path on how to seek out that delivery and value add they're looking for.
Okay, excellent. Now, there's this new buzzword that's being bandied about here in the cybersecurity industry that's called zero trust. And I believe that means you really just can't trust anybody, you know, for lack of a better term, both internal and external to your business environment. Could you expand more on what zero trust is and, like, if it's a good thing, bad thing, that in that area?
Before I delve into zero trust, I do want to give a shout out to John Kindervog, who, for those that may not recognize the name, he's best known for actually creating what we know as the zero trust model of cybersecurity. All of us in the industry, you know, our understanding, our application, evolution of it, really owe our success to his efforts when he was at Forrester Research. So. That's what really spoke to me, you know, reading up on a lot of that research and what I can apply today. So zero trust, you're exactly right. It's a cybersecurity strategy that addresses shortcomings of the failing legacy approaches to cybersecurity by removing that assumption of trust altogether. The point of zero trust is to not make networks, clouds, or endpoints more trusted. It's to, as you do solely put it, eliminate the concept of trust from all the digital platforms altogether. And going one step further, it's not just best practice. It's not just a recommendation. It really should be the foundational strategic security initiative for organizations, because we all know right now, you know, a breach, largely they're tied to several of, you know, various internal causes, whether they're malicious or accidental. And that means that sensitive business and customer data must be protected, and we do that by giving users the least amount of access that's needed for them to do their jobs. You know, I think that zero trust is also not just a one-size-fits-all, right? We need to think about how to tailor that for each organization. Zero trust is effectively architected by understanding what needs to be protected and then rolling that out as organizations need.
Okay, excellent. Now, what is that strategy? I mean, is there like an underlying concept or principle that you can expand on further?
Yeah. When we talk about strategy, it's really that prevention strategy that when, you know, implemented across the entire enterprise from network to endpoint to cloud, taking that comprehensive approach, it becomes that business enabler, right? Businesses are asking for flexibility, agility, nimbleness, the ability to get work done without hindrance. Zero Trust Network Architecture simplifies that protection of sensitive data and assets. And it's not just users, right? It's also endpoints, workloads, apps, and content, which we'll get into a little later on when we talk about Protect Surface. But the strategy behind it is really just rethinking of where and how we're applying controls within the environment.
Okay. Now, suppose company XYZ has implemented some kind of security model, like maybe the MITRE framework or the attack model for protecting their organization, and they attest to it's the best thing that they've ever adopted for their corporation. Now, how does Zero Trust different? How's it different from these other security models? And how should a company approach the Zero Trust model if they don't have a model in the first place? And how should they start implementing this? And should they do a phased-in approach for Zero Trust, or kind of bring it all at once, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's great. So I'll try to address all the key points there that you had mentioned. So let's set the stage that initially when a network or IT environment is stood up, most organizations, whether intentionally or unintentionally, give it that implicit attribute of trust, which is the problem, right? As we stated, trust is a vulnerability. And if you think about it, trust only benefits malicious actors, which, you know, folks, including, I mean, we use MITRE attack ourselves, right? I think it's a phenomenal framework that allows us to evaluate indicators on our environments and perform active threat hunting based on real-world activity we've seen of malicious actors. But the MITRE attack framework is enabled by allowing trust in the environment. So you think about this. Even segmented networks, right? The notion that an organization can be taken down and owned by whether it's a single set of credentials, a single application or service, that's what we're trying to avoid by going the zero trust route. Everything in an environment has a purpose. And through zero trust, its purpose is the only thing it should be allowed to do, not persistently. Which goes back to the challenges with securing information with legacy techniques that we've been trying to bolt patches on and we've been trying to uncover before they take us down. And as we walk through that list, you know, traditional segmentation, firewalling, and other methods of preventing malicious activity within the network don't scale efficiently or seamlessly integrate with cloud services, which is compounded because we don't have full visibility of application and data. And then layered on top of that, I think a lot of organizations have felt the burn of the administrative overhead that goes into applying a patchwork of controls throughout a large IT environment. And then you have things like privilege creep and other operational complexities that come into that. And I would say MITRE ATT&CK framework, if not done properly, could lead to some of those operational complexities, even though it's well-intended. And then lastly, again, the ability to change and enable the business at the speed it requires. So going back to that standard security model or maybe some of the legacy security models, the operation of assumption that everything on the inside of a network can be trusted, that's outdated. So new security practices have to be taken to stop and take a preventative approach as much as possible, only relying on things like MITRE to help, provide detection and remediation. And I'm a firm believer, both by practice and by experience, you know, Zero Trust is the only strategy that addresses all of these shortcomings on the whole.
Okay, excellent. Now, What are the specific challenges with securing, your digital assets, whether it's your IP, the personal identifiable information of your clients or what have you, with legacy techniques. And I think maybe on a different scale, a good example of this would be like the industrial control systems like SCADA, you know, like critical infrastructure. We know that these are technologies that have been deployed probably in the 1960s, 1970s, and there is a hard time trying to harden these technologies because they're just not really all that compatible with the new security technologies that we have today. They can't, in other words, you just can't rip out an old legacy system and put a new one in, right? You kind of have to leave it where it's at and then kind of add on to that. What are the challenges with doing something like that?
Yeah, I think that one of the misnomers sometimes of zero trust is that by consuming zero trust, we need to do that rip and replace. Zero trust does not advocate that we have to put in modern protection mechanisms. Now, as we define our protect surface and understand what that is, right, our data, applications, assets, and services, of which you just mentioned, you know, industrial devices or IoT devices, once we understand, you know, what data is there, how is it being manipulated, how should that device function, and how, you know, what's the right behavior, what services need to run on those, we might determine that our existing security control set or existing technology platform does not enable us to either limit or provide enough validation around those devices. So you might need to implement or add another mechanism to support a zero trust methodology, but it's certainly not number one. It's certainly not the driving factor. An industrial device or an IoT device, they're intended to perform a very finite set of functions and behave a certain way. By enforcing who can access those devices to, you know, just-in-time models, limiting the types of behavior that those devices exhibit, right? Whether it's ingress or egress, I think the biggest thing that folks need to understand is it requires 100% visibility, and that means using, you know, application-type rules within your network environment, and that needs to be enforced across the spectrum so that we're not necessarily worried about, you know, maybe an outdated device. It might represent a greater risk in your environment. But if I am applying my control set and methodologies in a manner that device cannot be, you know, used in a malicious manner, that's really what zero trust is all about, is enabling those functions to only function as intended and not allowing too much communication, too little communication, and being able to alert and take action if something goes against the policy set that we've enforced. And taking it back to the beginning of the question, that's, I think, sometimes where folks might get confused with, well, zero trust means I have to enforce all of these different capabilities everywhere in my environment. I need to go overhaul everything. When actuality, they may not need to do that, but they need to fill in that gap of having the basics really filled, right? You can say that they have IoT or industrial devices, but even before you get to zero trust, have they really administered the obvious? Have they documented and know where those crown jewels are, that the basics of any security strategy informing your risk register, right? Are they already enforcing policy standards and guidelines? And going back to supporting zero trust, are they already controlling access to those industrial or IoT devices? Knowing who has access to what, the administrators, and then the services. So having some of those basic things either answered or in place already makes the adoption of a zero trust methodology easier, no matter what the intended target is.
Okay, excellent. Now, why are all these models of trust, why are they broken? I mean, is it just because the companies just don't, they just don't give like the right levels of permissions to employees? Maybe sometimes they assign more than what's needed for a certain employee. Like, suppose maybe an administrative assistant, maybe he or she doesn't need like complete access to a virtual server. They can just get read privileges versus read, write, and execute, or is it just simply that they just don't implement their security policies? What are your thoughts on that?
It's a mixture of all of the above. I think that most organizations, and I keep saying most organizations because it's a little easier with a cloud-native organization or a brand-new organization to implement the controls in a more granular fashion if you're going cloud-first, but that's not indicative of most operations that are out there. We have networks and IT environments that were stood up with individuals that with either a single or a couple sets of credentials can get into several applications and services, and sometimes even roles themselves aren't either strictly enforced or checked enough. So there's persistent access versus just-in-time access. You have services and applications that might be able to respond to communications around the clock when they're only performing functions at certain times of the day, things that we would try to avoid in a zero trust methodology by only allowing communications specifically between certain apps, certain services, and then administered in a just-in-time manner by the right administrators. And even those individuals shouldn't be using credentials that allow them to impact every set of data applications, asset, and services that they can at every single time. So it serves no purpose for the organization to just ubiquitously give somebody trust that as soon as I validate who you are when you sign into a computer in the morning, right, that should by itself should not allow you to go out and perform, native administrator activities or a whole set of activities that are not indicative of your role or your job function, right? That's really the primary reason why the current model of trust is broken and why there are so many problems when employees are phished, when employees are, lose their sets of credentials and accounts within the organization, including service accounts, are hijacked because of the overly permissiveness of that to take down quite a bit of the network.
Okay, excellent. Now, you may have touched on this a little bit before in your previous questions, but now suppose company XYZ comes at you and says, Rob, I really want to implement a zero trust model. How do we do it right here and right now? And how do we do it full force and do it all, and do a 100% deployment? What do you tell them? Or can you help them actually walk through the whole process and maintain for them too as well?
Yeah. We could talk a little bit about, if they were going to embark on it, what are those driving factors? And then I'll even touch probably a little bit on where should they start if they want to explore that approach to security. Let's start off at the top level. This is really a business problem. It's not a security problem. And business leaders are aware of the challenges that face their IT and security teams. And we've been searching for answers for a long time. I think the security vendor industry is well aware of that. There's never a shortage of point answers or best of breed or different subscriptions, different capabilities for you to purchase that solve what seem to be new and increasing and more complex problems. But if we break this down to the simplest levels, the biggest issue is really that breakdown of traditional trust, and that once you authenticate, you get in most cases persistent access to a whole lot of resources. Zero trust being built upon that idea, again, that security has to be ubiquitous throughout the organization. That model is designed to be a strategic enabler and resonant at all levels of the organization. So all of a sudden, we're talking about the solution to a business problem, not just an IT problem or a security problem. Yet, it can be implemented by the teams using the commercial solutions they've already purchased. So why is that so important? It's important because it's designed to stop and prevent data breaches or prevent most of the incidents from occurring. And that's really what should be the direction of all of our IT security teams. It's not the security incidents that we are able to handle and contain. That's kind of like the blocking and tackling of information security. And one of the focal points of even MITRE, right? We're looking for the incidents and we're trying to stop them before they exploit and steal data. But a data breach itself can cause enormous disruption, everything from sensitive confidential information loss, regulatory or government fines, and then as we've seen in several organizations, you know, leadership positions that see a tremendous amount of turnover. So Zero Trust resonates because it's not just a cybersecurity initiative, cybersecurity strategy. It's really a business enablement and risk mitigation strategy, something that every individual at the C-level can get on board with. And so if an organization decides that they've got that buy-in and they want to start, looking at Zero Trust and how do we do that, there's really, I followed some of the same steps that when we rolled that out for our organization, how I advise others is the same steps that Mr. Kindervog, usually advises. And it's along the five things we're going to talk about now. Number one goes back to the basic blocking and tackling, administering the obvious. So defining the potential attack surface that you need to protect. Typically, a lot of organizations have like a risk register and they've done some risk management analysis. They know potentially where some of their biggest impact areas lie. But we need to think about this at a micro level. We need to reduce it to its smallest possible size. So you can have several protect services in an organization that could be attacked, and those are categorized as the smallest combination of data, assets, applications, and services. You then need to know where your transactions and how your data is flowing. I think we all have network diagrams that are constructed with our organizations, but do those network diagrams, do we have a whole picture of the organization and where is data, where are services, where are users accessing things, and where does it flow? It is at that point we can then architect that Zero Trust methodology because we can identify where the controls need to go. Organizations can then see, make sure that attack surface is surrounded by a micro perimeter policy, right? Segmentation gateways with layer 7 firewalls and policy management. So we've identified what the most critical asset is. We know how data flows. We've architected where the controls should go, but you might be able to take a step back and you're like, wow, I already have a lot of the bits and pieces of this in place. And so now all it is creating that policy of who, what, when, why, and how. The policy, your Zero Trust policy, has to be able to decide who and what passes that perimeter, that enforcement point. And it sounds like it's overly complex, right? Knowing, the who, what, when, why, and how, but it's not that complicated. We'll get into that here in a little bit. And then the last component is once the policy is implemented and defined, it's just monitoring and maintaining. Again, this isn't just a set it and forget it. It's not a shiny piece of hardware that you get off the shelf. This is a policy that instead of performing hours and hours of looking through your SIM or logs or your threat hunting framework, we're monitoring and maintaining the controls that are in place because we've limited our potential attack surface of where threats could be levered at.
Okay, excellent. Now, what are the business drivers behind Zero Trust? Is it more from a technical standpoint, but what are the business catalysts for implementing this kind of model? Is it more like cost savings or, COVID's hit, now we can't really trust anybody because there's so many new cyber attacks coming out. Could you expand on that in a little bit more detail, please?
There are, I think, at a minimum, four different business drivers behind Zero Trust. You hit the first one on the head, cost management and cost considerations. I would add into that personnel, the legacy architectures, and cloud. So if we talk about cost management, we all know the restraints on budgets and organizational resources that security teams face, even if there is a security team at an organization, right? I think we both know several organizations where security is part of others' responsibilities, even though there's no security team. Zero Trust helps maximize those limited resources. A lot of organizations adopt sort of like that startup mode, that startup mentality, when they go down the zero trust journey, because the CFO is not just going to open up his checkbook and say, zero trust sounds great, go make it happen. So we have to handle resources very carefully. You have to make sure all the spending is in line with what the team knows how to do, everybody's strengths. And in terms of maintainability and scalability on your long-term plan to implement zero trust. And personnel, this ties into cost management. All of our teams are already very lean. And in some organizations were faced to get even more lean through the COVID scenario that we all faced. And a lot of individuals are on top of that strained, I think, by the daily operational needs of an organization or fires that could come up, right? Zero trust means that we start small. We use the existing technology and solutions, the existing architecture, and we address the environment in a different way. It's just a different application of the methodologies that we've already rolled out. And we've talked about our typical IT environments not being very efficient, right? Most networks have grown into complex beasts over time, which hinders our ability to be agile and efficient. All of a sudden, you have this cloud thing, and mobility has enabled users to work from anywhere, and so our legacy IT capabilities are holding us back. Zero trust requires us to use our investments in a way to enable policies in IT to enable that flexible work environment where in the past we were concerned with just creating a hardened shell around environments, which brings us to cloud. A lot of organizations are continuing to try to collapse their infrastructure, reduce the number of services, reduce the number of applications to leverage cloud, whether it's infrastructure as a service, platform, or software as a service, all the way through containers. So how do you enforce controls on that? How is traffic managed? How do we get comfortable with what happens in a hybrid cloud methodology or hybrid cloud scenario? Because I know very few organizations that are single cloud. We have IT everywhere. So how do you maintain visibility and control? And if you're following a zero trust methodology and you're concerned with the data, assets, applications, and services, and we know the minimum type of controls that we need to put in place, it doesn't matter where my application lives. It doesn't matter where my users have to access. I need to ensure that the same level of control is present there. And so that by itself nudges you in a direction that is very cloud-friendly and cloud-enabled.
Okay, excellent. Now, as I said before, zero trust, I think the biggest, maybe one of the falsehoods is that, you can't trust anybody, and suppose you have some employees that have worked with you for 10 years and all of a sudden you said, hey, I'm implementing the zero trust model, we just can't trust anybody anymore, that will lead to some psychological misgiving. So apart from this, what are some of the other misconceptions or falsehoods that you know of with the zero trust model?
Sure. You hit the first one. It's the goal to eliminate that concept of trust. So the second misconception is that zero trust is only enforcing identity. I think that's ubiquitous with a lot of solutions out there pushing that identity is your firewall in a hybrid cloud world. Identity is going to be that savior. And don't get me wrong. Identity is an extremely critical leg of zero trust, but zero trust doesn't mean we're only enforcing identity. Any traffic, any behaviors, any actions that someone's identity performs has to be validated, it has to be authenticated, and it has to be checked for unauthorized activity using 100% visibility on your network. And you have to extend that across all of your operating environments, which requires you to use, network protections, endpoint protections, et cetera. So I don't want folks to think that I don't think identity is important. I think it's critical, but zero trust is not the same thing as identity. They're closely related. Zero Trust is not a product. Zero Trust is a methodology. Zero Trust is a set of design guidance that is structured to be rigid enough that you have to follow a same set of common principles to obtain close enough full Zero Trust, but it's nimble enough that you can implement it with varying degrees to align with the business. It's nimble enough that you don't need to apply the same amount of controls with something that is, consumer-friendly versus protected health information, for example. And then the last one is that Zero Trust is really complicated. It sounds complicated, but it really is not. We talked about focusing on the most critical applications in data sets, and that's where you start building your strategy and deploying it. One of the most recent surveys that I had read, and one of the figures that I saw is deploying Zero Trust can actually reduce security costs over a five-year term by close to 31%. And so where the complicatedness comes into play is you're asking organizations to enforce the basic blocking and tackling that should already be in play. And sometimes it's not in play, and so all of a sudden Zero Trust sounds like it's this complicated journey because now I have to go figure out what assets are on my network, what software's on my network, who has accounts. That should already be part of the normal operational process. So I think that's where the complicatedness of Zero Trust comes into play. It's forcing folks to clean up that basic building blocks.
Yeah, excellent. Now, are there any special tools or needs to implement a Zero Trust model or any technologies that you are aware of?
That is the beauty of Zero Trust. Not necessarily. You have the ability to start with what you have and just use the Zero Trust principles, the Zero Trust methodology and concepts to determine, well, do I really need to enhance my tool set to accommodate what I want to do? And you can make that determination in a couple of different ways. Number one is focusing on those business outcomes. Again, you're going to get more support for your Zero Trust initiatives by partnering and focusing on the business and showing them how you can enable them. What does the business need to accomplish? Quite a bit. We've seen that network and security teams sometimes don't map even the business requirements or their own projects together to show how they're moving the business forward. So that can show one or both teams being an inhibitor instead of an enabler. And that's not what we want to have happen. We need to change that conversation. And then we need to start from the most basic levels and work our way out towards the organization. Whereas in the past, I think one of the biggest drivers was we need to put the biggest firewall or the biggest IPS, the biggest load balancer in front of our network. And then we'll worry about the internal controls later. It's sort of that in reverse. That way, we're applying the controls where the critical data lives and then layering on outward instead of starting from the outside or working our way in. Then we really then go to performing the architecting of that Zero Trust network. Again, it's customized. It's not a universal design. But that architecture is constructed around your protect surface, which is, again, the critical data, application, assets, and services that we're focusing on. And then you're able to layer on the controls outwardly from that. Typically, I've seen folks most create a what's called like a micro perimeter using some sort of layer 7 firewall. I think most organizations have probably deployed something very similar in capability, right? There's a whole lot of vendors out there that provide layer 7 or next-gen firewall capabilities. And so leveraging that technology investment you've already made and enforcing a micro perimeter around your protect services. And then you can enable all those fancy features that you already have paid for and implemented to get that application visibility. Again, you've defined what you want to protect, and you protect it by understanding everything that goes in and out. I would say then that the last couple of points being once you've done that, you have the 100% visibility. Now you can enforce that policy. You know the who, what, when, why, where, and how. of who needs access, what needs to communicate, and then really tune and tighten that policy that you're enforcing. One of the recommendations that I've seen that people use is what's called the Kipling method to do that. And that's something you can go on and Google, right? It helps you whitelist which resources should have access to others. And it was Kipling who put together that initial concept. And so you use your transaction flows using the Kipling method to narrow that down. And then the last component would just be, maintaining and tuning. Because once you've wrapped the protection, once you've identified, the W's, you can then maintain, inspect, and tune. And then you apply that same methodology as you work your way out.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm the kind of guy that likes to, if I'm going to implement something new, I'd like to see it being done like in phases where there's an all-blown approach to it. Like instead of just putting something into my line of business 100%, I like to do it in phased, gradual approaches. I don't want to jump in the swimming pool unless I know how deep it is, obviously. That's the analogy to use. Are there any KPIs to show a company the incremental progress and or successes that they're doing with implementing a zero trust model, or if they use that phased in approach I was just talking about?
Definitely, and I would recommend that the phased in approach absolutely be followed, and it would be even greater that if there's a new net new segment within the environment or the cloud that the organization is standing up or consuming, you could start there, net new versus trying to overhaul. But yeah, absolutely, phasing it in is key. And to establish that cadence, that those KPIs and that reporting, one of the biggest recommendations is to establish what is generally known as that zero trust center of excellence, or like a coalition or some sort of a committee within the organization. So if we think about what zero trust is, again, it's that business enabler. So, ensuring that coalition or that committee is made up of the key business personnel, you can identify milestones and success criteria and report on those KPIs, everything from operational to project management and whatnot, and tie that back to the business. This allows everyone to stay on the same page and understand what the problem we're trying to solve is, define as many solution sets and key outcomes, and schedule those progress updates and milestones. And then the team will be able to draft and approve that end state, and it should be relatively quick to identify those, as you mentioned, those key efficiencies and potential cost savings, and that group as a team should vet the progress along the way. From there, they can then refine the overall business case and strategy, and that helps you show that the value set out to deliver from the initial proposal is actually coming to fruition in the smallest baby steps as possible, working your way towards larger deployments. So every organization relies on different KPIs, different check-in points. Some organizations use waterfall, some use agile. So your rollout method, your implementation method, and your check-ins are going to vary with what the organization, what they have at their disposal and how they operate. But getting that committee, that group, that knows what they're setting out to deliver and can work together, that's really where you're going to be able to track your incremental progress and deliver your results and ultimately show the business how you're executing.
Okay, excellent. Now, in cybersecurity, a lot of organizations tend to overlook fortifying the endpoint. So, for example, with the remote workforce day as an example, suppose John Doe is working remotely and he's trying to access shared files on a corporate server. Everybody's worried about securing those lines of communication between the server and his laptop and vice versa, like the VPNs, encryption, cryptography, so forth. But nobody really seems to pay as much attention to the endpoints, which are the points of origination, points of destination, like the server and the laptop. Now, I think people are starting to realize this, and they think simply, installing anti-malware, spyware, software patches is going to be enough, and that's not really enough because the cyber attacker can use, you know, fileless, you know, attacks to, you know, threat vectors where they can pretty much go and they can go hidden and nobody will even detect them. Now, how can you apply zero trust to further fortify these endpoints to a much greater level than what existing antivirus or anti-malware software packages can do?
That's a fantastic question, a great point. I think it's something a lot of organizations are trying to figure out and or struggling with right now, especially that we have most of our employees working in what I would call a hostile environment. And I say that and chuckle. It's not because, you know, families and kids are around us a lot more, right? It's because being at home or working from anywhere is essentially to being, you know, flat out there on the internet, right? And the internet is a hostile environment. So we talk about the endpoint itself, antivirus, traditional mechanisms to stopping abnormal activity. Like those are control points that are only looking at what is to be known bad, right? If there's any auditors or security personnel listening that have gone through those evaluations where you have to show that you're receiving signatures on a regular basis, that they're applied, that we're doing routine scans, that's a pretty taxing way of protecting endpoints. Zero Trust looks at the solution through the lens of, well, what is normal and only required for just-in-time access, where antivirus doesn't take into account anything beyond what it knows is bad. So we need something more intelligent than just a legacy antivirus or a legacy VPN even. Antivirus can be a component. A lot of organizations I know have gotten rid of traditional antivirus and now use solutions that look at more than just known bad and can enforce zero trust on the endpoint. So all of a sudden now you're looking at behavioral-based, machine-based, and cloud-enabled solutions that deliver endpoint detection and response or everything detection and response and really prevent abnormal activity from occurring on the endpoint. And here's why it's so critical to zero trust, right? We talked about zero trust needing 100% visibility and applying that policy approach to preventing unwanted activity. When you have an endpoint solution on an endpoint device that's looking for abnormal activity and preventing it from occurring, and we couple that with something more robust than a VPN like a SASE. So for those that are listening that may have not heard SASE, it stands for Secure Access Service Edge. And SASE is just a term that Gartner coined, and it's really like the convergence and amalgamation of several technologies into one solution that kind of looks and feels like VPN, kind of acts like VPN, but it really gives you your WAN, your network security services like firewall as a service, cloud access security broker, SD-WAN, all of that stuff into one like cloud delivered model. And so all of a sudden, those same policies that you have on your network, you can enforce them on your endpoint. You can enforce them from any device connecting to your environment, and you get that 100% visibility. And it's, you know, becoming a key component to that safely work from anywhere.
Okay, excellent. Now, before we started the podcast, Ron, we had a little bit of a conversation about, you know, using cloud, you know, platforms like the AWS or Azure. Now, how have these cloud environments, or Google Cloud, or for that matter, how have they adopted the zero trust model? And how should how should they implement the zero trust model if they make heavy usage of the AWS or Azure? In other words, suppose they have their entire IT infrastructure in the cloud. How should they implement the zero trust model that way versus an on-prem fashion?
The great thing about those cloud-native environments is that, by definition, they're software-defined networks that lend themselves to enabling that micro-perimeter and inspection and content analysis. So requiring that visibility and context for all traffic, you get now in the cloud an easy way to do the zoning capabilities, those dynamic address or security groups and device tagging. And if we implement some sort of that micro perimeter inspection with like a layer 7 firewall capability, that allows us to get that 100% visibility and do all that policy enforcement at a micro perimeter level in those public clouds. And, you know, it's necessary, you know, to secure that external perimeter going into your cloud, but it's even more crucial to do that traffic as it crosses between the different functions within that cloud network. And adding other like verification methods increases your abilities to verify users correctly, right? So I've seen folks implement, I think in the Microsoft world, it might be known as like hub and spoke, right? And then in AWS, you have the transit gateway options to have north, south, east, west visibility, and then segment amongst your different zones and inspect all of the traffic. And then layering on that zero trust methodology, that's where you then can enforce those business processes, data flows, and risks in a very, using what the clouds have already deployed in that cloud native mechanism, and you can then extrapolate that to any other environment once you have that defined. And the great thing that you just called out is it's really location agnostic, so it supports those that are using those multi-cloud environments.
Okay, excellent. Now, should the zero trust model be used only for virtual assets like digital assets, or can it be used for physical assets as well too? So, for example, we use the example of, you know, using shared resources and server. And you may also have, like, if you're like a law firm, you may have, like, you know, legal documents for a client stored physically, like physical documents stored in a separate locked room. Can a zero trust model be applied to both worlds, or what are your recommendations on that?
Absolutely. It should be applied to everything, not just critical assets, and not just doing that cost benefit on those. I think we need to start on those critical assets, those digital assets, but everywhere that data exists, and no matter in what form, while the damage, like a malicious actor, impacting that less critical asset, or we might think there's a less of a risk, it just reorganizes the manner in which we're going to attack and implement those policies, right? At the end of the day, like a breach is still a breach, no matter where the breach occurs or what data is lost. Data loss is data loss. So spending some time to think about all of the different protect surfaces and all those different manners, as you just mentioned, apply that methodology that enables that uniform way to secure the environment. And it can be both logical and physical security methods. And you're going to have different controls depending on the data criticality in the different environments. Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Now, are there any financial costs that are associated with the zero trust model? I mean, since it's pretty much founded in theory, what are some of the technological pieces that have to go with it? Like, what are the capital expenditures like company XYZ needs to take into consideration if they're going to implement the zero trust framework?
Yeah, that's a big thing we get all the time is, hey, you're advocating I use zero trust, but you're telling me to go adopt something that possibly has a zero to infinite cost on it, and how am I going to get support for it, right? I mean, you need to have some idea of the finite investment. Ideally, zero trust should be applied to all assets, but some organizations can choose to accept more risk on less critical assets. If an organization has said it's fine, I'm not going to implement zero trust on everything, they need to start experimenting with some less critical assets with the notion in mind that my primary target is going to be my crown jewels. Because you need to test the methodology, you need to test the control methods, but you need to do it in a way that's not going to interrupt the business, disrupt the business. Once you've validated your approach, once you've proven your metrics, then you can move on to those crown jewels in the organizations where you really reap those bigger benefits. And by messing with the less critical assets, you're going to understand more clearly what some of those cost ramifications are, whether you can use internal resources, whether you need to upgrade or expand skill set and knowledge to tweak your environment, whether you need to use a consultant to help you out, whether you really do need new technology or not. The cost will vary depending on what we can leverage in our existing environment, which is always my recommendation. Only after a true gap analysis on what's present what needs to be resolved, and what what additional efficiencies we're delivering to the business, what risks we're mitigating. Once you've quantified that in some manner that you're mitigating or offsetting the potential investment costs, then we can move forward. But there are zero costs besides time to using the methodology to develop a plan and lay the groundwork. And I realize everybody is busy, and some even busier than they used to pre-COVID. But a little bit of time here and there to lay the groundwork, to develop that plan, to really understand how can I reduce that protect surface to the smallest area possible to implement zero trust methodology, you all of a sudden will realize there's not a lot of potential added cost given a lot of the infrastructure and services that some organizations have invested in. So it's entirely possible at the end of the day you might need to potentially buy a couple of virtual firewalls to protect certain areas on the network. You might need to tweak your identity solution or enhance your identity solution. You might need to go back to some of your operations folks and make sure that a CMDB is accurate, because you need accurate asset information, both hardware and software. You might need to clean up some of the tech debt in the organization before you move forward. There are some of those things that don't come with any direct added cost, but come with time cost. And that's probably where the biggest consumption factor is going to be initially.
Yeah, excellent. Now, what is the popularity of Zero Trust right now? I think, if my understanding is correct, it's still kind of a very new, I guess, for lack of a better term, buzzword in cyber. How many companies in the U.S. do you know of that are actually implementing this model on a full force basis, 100% deployment?
I only know of a handful of organizations that were, one, born in the cloud. They implemented Zero Trust from the very beginning, and that allowed them to implement it correctly and most of the requirements to achieve near full Zero Trust, right? But that's starting from scratch. That's having the ability with no technical debt, which is not the most common example, right? That's the rare instance. Many organizations will define their level of risk acceptance high enough that it might only make sense to implement Zero Trust concepts across 50%, maybe 75%, maybe 25% of their environment. Although the costs continue to refine, is less and less once you've achieved your first few deployments and tweaks. Many organizations have, like I said, invested in the platforms that have the capability to support Zero Trust and enforce it. And a lot of the groundwork to make it successful is that biggest difficulty, understanding where data is located, making sure data governance is rock solid. Probably 60%, if I were to estimate, of the organizations that I speak with have the basic requirements to begin implementing Zero Trust in one area of another of the organization. And that's because they have a solid data identity, data governance, and protection program in place. It's then just taking it to that next step along a potential capability maturity model, moving up in that direction to gain the benefits of operating in that direction. So your cost and where organizations are might be directly related to the governance and identity and detection mechanisms that they've had in place. Something else that's interesting, although it might not surprise many folks, is the organizations that are highly regulated have, in this instance, a leg up than those that don't, because in a lot of the regulations, you're required to know where your most critical data is. You're required to have some sort of data governance and identity program in place to varying degrees. That's not saying that regulatory compliance and governance is making them secure by any means, but it's one area in which those organizations have a leg up on those that might have not made that a focal point of their security control environment, right? So In some manners, we need to look at all domains of information security, both the basic building blocks to the more advanced controls that mitigate some of the threats that our organizations have defined in our risk registers, and start there and leverage what we've built in place. But it's primarily been mostly adopted by those organizations that went cloud first and those organizations that have the a great idea of where their crown jewels are and have really locked down on the who can access those from where, which identity, and that really rein in access, because they've realized the cost benefit for moving up the chain. It's a lot less cost for a lot more benefit.
Okay, well, now, can a company actually do the Zero Trust framework all by themselves, or do you recommend that they do a combination with their IT security team and maybe outsource it to another vendor like yourself?
Well, sure, they can absolutely do it themselves. And I would recommend most of them actually do it themselves if they have the cycles to take what's freely available from both vendors and research organizations and apply it internally. I think that allows them to get the most buy-in. However, yeah, absolutely. On the flip side, 30 to 40% of the organizations that I've spoken to do either use a partner initially or bring someone in for like a workshop type scenario to help walk them through and create those artifacts that the organization will take and move forward. Of course, yeah, absolutely. They can reach out to myself, my organization for some guidance and information on, where they should start. At what point along the way do we feel comfortable with moving forward? And there's different organizations that help at various stages too, whether it's, like I said, the initial guidance and just focus in the direction, all the way through the policy definition on the technical controls in their environment. That Zero Trust Coalition that I mentioned earlier, that's going to be the biggest determination of whether they decide that they want to build it themselves. You're going to get a good fit if the culture is already adapted to thinking that way and supporting across organizational alignment. And if the building blocks are not there, then yeah, I would absolutely turn to like a trusted partner that can help you. And if you're looking for someone that to guide all the way through implementation, I would recommend just asking your peers, asking other cloud service providers or partners like us, well, what should we do? Where should we go? What are some recommendations? And we're going to focus on the business outcomes to give you concrete direction and recommendations moving forward. And that enables you to not go talk to maybe like a product vendor, right? Because if you go down the Zero Trust path looking for a product, you're not going to realize the true benefits. It's not a product. So I would stay away from vendors directly if you're trying to figure out what Zero Trust is or whether you should implement. Only after you've identified where you need to go and if you have a gap, then I would figure out, how am I going to fill that gap?
Okay. Now, are there any minimum requirements to adopt the Zero Trust framework? Are there any minimum staffing requirements or technological requirements that you're aware of?
I'm probably going to get a little bit of hate mail for this, but I'm going to use the wonderful answer, it varies. But it really does vary from organization to organization, right? Some organizations, outsource information security fully to like an MSS. With like a 24/7 SOC and that organization, operates their environment. Some do it all in-house and there's others in between. The resource requirements themselves aside, any organization can identify that wonderful protect surface and who accesses the data. That's going to give you bits and pieces of how complex a journey exists to actually implement and refine Zero Trust. That will then lead to telling you whether you're adequately staffed, have adequate partners that are built into your ecosystem, and whether that's something you want to invest in or not. Because we talked about before, all of our time has a monetary component. We can be doing other activities with our time. It's expensive to use the existing MSSP partner because they're going to throw teams of people at these solutions. So if we go back to like minimum team resource requirements to establish it, I would say zero investment to establish that committee and start talking about it internally. And it's probably even free to have the initial conversations with a partner and MSSP, but only through that initial discovery are we going to find out, well, what do we really need to have in place to maintain? If your operational component within your organization can maintain the zero trust environment after it's implemented, then I would say, once it's implemented and refined, then it's just the fine tuning, right? Then it's just if I were to liken it to owning a car, right? Then it's just the oil changes, the wipers, the tires. It's just doing the routine maintenance to keep it running. But to actually, build the vehicle, you need somebody that's got that framework, that blueprint, if you don't have the resources right to do it yourself.
Yeah, speaking of that, I've never trusted fixing my own car. It probably caused more damage to it. Anyway, is there an organization that actually not mandates, but has certified the Zero Trust framework? There's like NIST and, we have CMMC approach, the DoD is mandating. Is there an external third-party entity that's actually certified the Zero Trust framework or give support to it? Do you know where I'm kind of going with this question?
Absolutely. So very similar to I have to be PCI compliant or I have to be ISO compliant.
Right,
I can
right.
bring in a firm to validate my control environment. They can tell me whether or not that I have the minimums in place to get that certification, right?
Exactly. That's what I was trying to get at.
Okay. So yes, NIST has published a zero trust guide. I think there's a lot of other organizations out there, both consultants and vendors alike, and research entities that publish both frameworks, guidelines, and solution sets for how you apply this in your environment. But to my knowledge, there's not a independent third party that can come in and assess what you have done and say, yep, this checks the box to zero trust. And I think that's actually a good thing because that enables the flexibility in the application of zero trust. It puts the ownership in each organization to understand how and to what degree that I'm implementing these controls. I would say the benefit to doing zero trust is not to just say, hey, I'm doing this, it's going to lower my risk posture, but by virtue of implementing zero trust, not only are you enabling that business efficiency and the agility in making your operations more secure and more efficient, but by going down this path, you're enabling an easier and less painful way to fall in line with all of your regulatory compliance options, right? So you may not, there may not be a zero trust auditor, right? But if you're subject to, let's go back to either PCI DSS, Cloud Security Alliance, NIST 853, et cetera. If you're subject to a lot of those requirements to varying degrees, having a zero trust guided methodology and control set in place greatly simplifies and reduces the amount of administrative overhead to remain in compliance with those frameworks.
Okay. Now, to what degree does FNTS and other MSSPs support the zero trust techniques in the products? Is it just one part of your product offering, or do you offer other services that can be used in tangential with the zero trust framework?
Most MSSPs and the solutions that support the zero trust capabilities within the solutions or reference architectures. But to fully consume the benefits and migrate to zero trust, most MSSPs that I'm aware of, including FNTS, will typically bring in a partner or develop an internal statement of work or professional services engagement that takes the reference architecture, takes the blueprints for the digital transformation initiatives, layers what folks are doing existingly along like a capability maturity model, or layering it onto the organization's existing security program model to understand, number one, what gaps need to be resolved, what the prioritization is, three, what resources are available, and then a time estimate to do that, and so forth. The biggest thing with working with an MSSP, including FNTS, is how to apply those capabilities more granularly to enforce the needed mechanisms and achieve the assurance required, and ultimately get on a path to reducing costs long term. So we do provide, like I said, that solution set that is zero trust capable, that can help support those zero trust policies. It's only after we understand and work with that business that we can identify, well, what do they have in place? What can we help migrate them to, and then tune going forward? So if you're an organization that has identified, well, what I have in place won't let me enforce zero trust, then yeah, then I think the cloud service provider and MSSP, that would get you the technology component, and it would get you access to the partner component and knowledge component to help you refine that. But just migrating to an MSSP, or even just migrating to a cloud like AWS or Azure or Google, that by itself won't get you zero trust, but it puts you on a platform that is easily integratable in supporting the enforcement of zero trust techniques and products.
Okay. Now, as we wrap up our show here, Robert, just the final two questions here. We've talked heavily about the technical implications of the zero trust framework. Are there any psychological implications of this too? Because, for example, like we talked about biometrics before the show started, there's a tech side, but there's also that psychological side, and biometrics does have that, very much has that psychological issue, especially with facial recognition. Can you equate that to the same plane for the zero trust model?
Yeah, there's certainly some challenges and some roadblocks, I would say, when it comes to not just implementing, but gaining the buy-in and the support for the zero trust environment. Business buy-in is the biggest issue and challenge, has been for the majority of folks I have advised and worked with. This is because you have to obtain the information necessary to enforce all of the requirements, right? You need the basic data to do that just-in-time access, the least privilege, and you need to talk to data owners, right? You need to understand how things are being consumed, et cetera. Most organizations don't readily know, sometimes rely on technical teams, business units, et cetera, to help answer the question. And at the end of the day, I think it's pretty common that a lot of people have too much access. Data is everywhere. It doesn't need to be. That then forces a business to go, oh my goodness, they throw their hands up, right? And they're looking at a dramatic shift and to change how work gets done. Sometimes folks have over-customized things to that organization, and Zero Trust is advising, let's take it a more standardized approach. And that change right there is difficult to get on board with and difficult to implement if everybody's not willing to adjust course and see the strategic alignment and enabler with the organization, right? I would say on the other end of that coin in the journey is that an organization that goes down that path and understands, how to free themselves of that tech debt, how to move to that standardized consumption model, that standardized protection model, will be on the journey primed for digital transformation in that standardized format, which goes back to where you and I were talking before the call as well about digital transformation and how COVID has forced, I think, folks' hand, that things that might have been in the pipeline or planned need to be accelerated, hopefully not rushed to a degree that it's adding or increasing risk. But we've seen a difference in those that were ready for digital transformation and those that were scrambling, or those that had a plan that just needed to execute on it. And then I think the fear, the psychological fear of zero trust, and you're going to be taking away rights, you're going to be taking away my ability to get things done. But in actuality, it's just what we should have been doing all along, right? It's securing the obvious. It's making sure we're securing our crown jewels and controlling privileged access, and even as basic as how do you resolve an incident, guiding, assisting, and training. So you're really forcing folks to admit that not everything is as well oiled as it should be. And I think that is the biggest challenge and psychological challenge and block to implementing zero trust is you don't want to point out too many flaws. You have to phrase everything as in the business benefits and the improvements that you're making. There's a lot of things that will be fixed naturally as a result of that, but that's where a lot of the pitfalls are.
Okay, excellent. Now, just one more question. Now, the cybersecurity threat landscape is obviously dynamically changing, and even more so now with COVID-19, there are more threat variants coming out. How effective will the Zero Trust framework be in combating all these new threat variants coming this year and going well into the next couple of years?
I apologize. My phone broke up a little bit. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. The cyber threat landscape is always changing. It always was being before COVID hit, but now with COVID, it's exploded into a whole new different direction. How can the Zero Trust framework protect or mitigate the risk of cyber attacks from COVID or other threat variants, other threat vectors this year and coming into the future years? How effective do you think it will be?
Zero Trust is probably the most effective strategic enabler and model with a prevention-focused approach to mitigating and avoiding the impact of an incident, whether it's pre-COVID, post-COVID, and flexible for the future. And that's because of the basic building blocks of Zero Trust in itself. If all of our organizations have insight to 100% of the data flows on our networks and our IT environments, if we are controlling the access to all of the data applications, assets, and services, and we've architected our controls to enable the business supporting the security controls that we have in place, it doesn't matter what the threat or the initiative is, right? Whether I'm throwing somebody into a coffee shop or working from home indefinitely, whether my business is going to be acquired or go acquire another business itself, you start moving down the pipeline. When you have to open up your network and think of if your entire environment was operating on the internet itself, and we want to be able to get the assurance that nobody can get in and no data can get out without us validating that it's normal activity. And if you start thinking about that, that covers the majority of business processes that we need to protect both now and for the foreseeable future. And it should be architected that it's flexible enough to adapt to the changing business needs. So it's one of the best strategies to prepare for the future and as a hedge against interruptions that you can't foresee.
And finally, Robert, what's the best way for a prospect or someone interested in the Zero Trust framework, perhaps even from our audience listening in today, what's the best way to reach out to you and contact you for further consultation or even for a possible deployment?
Hey, if somebody wants to have additional discussions, follow-up, or wants to reach out to myself and my organization, please visit our website. That's fnts.com, and there'll be links on there to get in touch with our team, and you'll probably see a link. My information should be on there. If not, ask the individuals that are on the contact page to get a hold of either myself, member of my team, and we'll be more than happy to have a conversation and check out any of the free resources that are available to you as you're thinking about not just securing your digital transformations, but your digital transformation itself. You might have had your hand forced through COVID or because of COVID or even have plans accelerating. And if you want to take back some of that control, security aside, I know our organization and team would be more than happy to help and have a conversation.
Okay. Rob, we thank you for your time, Stephanie. You really shed a lot of insight on the Zero Trust framework. I've written some small articles for clients on this, and I was aware of the topic, but I've learned a lot from this podcast. I think it's one of the best ones we've ever had so far. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take care. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.